Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And we are going to be joined by some good guests today, but right now we're going to be talking about a little bit of basketball. And it's funny how you and I were both watching the same thing. I guess it's kind of indicative of the fact that neither one of us has a life. But both of us were watching the late game on ESPN, UCLA, and Oregon, which ordinarily would mean absolutely nothing to anybody except for as a USC guy, I was happy with the fact that UCLA was going to lose again after letting Steve Alford go. Like, hey, anything that makes UCLA sink even further like a stone, I'm fine with. However, that was not to be.
No, and I thought the same thing. I mean, first of all, I just happened to flip it on. What game is on? I see they're on, and one of the first attractions to that game is Pac-12. All right, you know Bill Walton's going to be on the call.
Right.
So if you want a little entertainment, you want to stop in and see what he's up to.
Right. And out here, I never get really any Pac-12. I'm either watching Duke or some kind of iteration of Kentucky or Kansas. I mean, no disrespect to, obviously, Kansas. The other two, meh.
Right.
But it seems like any game that you turn on ESPN is that. So I was excited to get a little bit of Pac-10 basketball or Pac-12, the Conference of Champions. And you throw it on, and yes, you get Bill Walton, but you also get MacArthur Court at the University of Oregon, which has been redone.
Yep, fun visual. And to your point, as a anti-UCLA guy, Oregon was up by 13, yes. Up by 13 with 2.5 minutes to go.
Yeah.
So the only reason I was really staying tuned in was, again, for the entertainment from Bill Walton.
The word salad, as it was from Bill Walton.
So
just an array of subjects and predicates thrown out with little regard for whether they actually were meant to join or make sense together.
It's good stuff.
It would be like if you told a word generator to write haiku.
Yeah.
That would be what you would get. Bill Walton.
Well, we were treated to some classic basketball strategy down the stretch because UCLA started playing the foul game, the make the three game, the get fouled on a three and make all three free throws game.
Right. The only way that you make that sort of a comeback last night, because they were trailing by 9 with a minute left, the only way that you make that comeback is being able to score with the clock not running.
Right. And Oregon, they went along with the plan because after Jalen Hands, point guard for UCLA, he made a three-pointer with 38 seconds to go. So they're down 8. Now they're down 5. But 5 seconds later, after a turnover, they foul Hands on a three-pointer. He makes all three free throws. So in 5 seconds, he scored 6 points.
Right. They make up 6.
So the lead goes from 8 down to 2. They play the foul game. But then everything got crazy when they send UCLA to the line down 3.
Yep.
With 2 seconds left.
Right. I think that was about, it's just bad. That was about where I fell asleep.
I don't know how you did that.
I feel so bad.
I don't know how you did that.
I don't know either. I don't know. I just don't, and I'm regretting it. Anyway, continue.
So they're down 3 with 2 seconds left. They go to the line for 2 free throws. They make the first. UCLA subs in the big guys to get on the paint to try and get the offensive rebound, and Hands misses the second free throw on purpose. UCLA gets the tip, and then it bounces away to the side, and a guy who had been outside the three-point line at the start of the free throw, he has come all the way into the lane to the right block. Nobody checks him. He scoops up the loose ball, scores it, and he gets fouled. So he ties the game at 80, gets fouled. Now he goes to the line with a free throw to win the game, 0.7 seconds left.
Right.
He misses.
Of course.
Of course.
Why not? Yeah. So why would you want everything wrapped up in a nice little package when you can play overtime and still have a chance to lose?
Right. I was kind of surprised that after he missed the free throw, they go to overtime, UCLA was able to win. You know, they were able to overcome that crazy emotional swing. But there were so many little things that happened with the fundamentals of basketball in those last few seconds. I mean, first of all, Oregon did a poor job of boxing out on the block to allow the UCLA guy to get his hands on the ball to begin with. Second of all, the guy on the perimeter for Oregon didn't box out the guy on the perimeter for UCLA. So, as I said, he was able to go untouched all the way from the three-point line into the block.
And at that point, you have one job. If you're Oregon, you have one job to do.
Exactly.
You box out.
That's it.
Like, that's your only job.
Yeah. And the guy outside on the three-point line for Oregon just sort of slowly walked into the lane. He didn't box out anybody.
Right.
And if he had just, if he had just sprinted to the block, you know, whoever can get their hands on the ball, go get it for Oregon, but he didn't. And so UCLA has this amazing offensive rebound, and then they foul him on the play too.
Right. It was just an utter mess. Well, and you think about it though, yeah, you think UCLA might lose in overtime, but Oregon has also just gacked up a 13-point lead. Like, that also enters in, but it immediately brings back memories. Oddly enough, 20 years ago, which just makes me feel pure old, I could tell you the house that I was living in, where I was watching the game. I was watching it with my friends. USC was playing against Oregon.
Same court?
Same court. It didn't look the same. January 7th, 1999. If you want to find it, you can find it on YouTube by searching greatest college basketball comeback of all time. You hadn't seen it as a basketball fan. It was because in 1999, this was the kind of thing we did. We talked about of the century.
Right.
And this was basically for a couple weeks, people were talking about it like this was the comeback of the century. And it's going to ultimately wind up in the dustbin of history, same as last night's will, because one team of the Pac-12 is going to make the NCAA tournament. This game will have no bearing on who makes postseason basketball, because whoever wins the Pac-12 tournament is going to be who winds up going there. But what happened in this one, a guy named Adam Spanish, it's funny, you go through and you watch that highlight and you get a shot of Brian Scalabrine.
Right.
20 years ago, a very young Scalabrine. And USC inbounds the ball, kicks it to the corner to Spanish, who hits a three. USC, which had been down 84 to 79, USC is now down 84-82. What does Oregon do? They get it underneath their basket and they go to inbound it, and they inbound it to half court, thinking
0.8 seconds left.
It's just going to touch somebody, and the clock's going to start, and it's going to be over. Well, who intercepts it? The same guy who hit the three, who has apparently run some kind of a curl route, gets out to half court, intercepts the pass, one dribble, shoots a half quarter, goes in. USC wins 85-84, and that's it. Ball game.
Amazing finish.
But so, yeah, I went and found this one on YouTube. Somebody actually went as far as to find it and stick it up there. But it is back, I think, before Fox Sports was really even a thing, because I think it was on like Prime Ticket, which was the Nesson of Southern California. But so, yeah, Oregon on their home court twice, almost 20 years apart, victimized by a completely improbable or impossible comeback.
Yeah, and you're right. It's funny how you described that 1999 comeback with the curl route, because it was almost the announcers afterwards on that clip were talking about how they were joking about, we need a 5-point play.
Yeah.
And it was almost like they strategized two plays together of, you know, make the three in the corner, and then he runs all the way back to half court, makes the steal, and then makes that the second 3-pointer from half court. Just an amazing few seconds for that player.
And it's just funny how that works. And if you look in the comments on YouTube, there's Brian Scalabrine saying, hey, is that me? yes,
yeah,
it
that's
was.
You no
yes.
doubt.
And that was
the one and only
a long professional career, oddly enough. So yeah, that's what went on in the world of college basketball. Duke apparently has now reclaimed their spot, and I don't think, as much as I want to believe it, I don't think anybody's gonna unseat Duke as the number one this year.
It doesn't really matter, I think, in the top five, because they are the most talented. So it's just a matter of how they progress, and are they peaking in March with their non-dunker, Zion Williamson?
Yeah, they're a good team. He's the non-dunker, but he's banging in threes now.
Did you hear that quote from him?
Is that what he said?
He doesn't want to be known as a dunker.
It's like Michelangelo not wanting to be known as a painter.
Exactly. After his breakaway 360 dunk that was incredible, that he said was like a 7 or 8. For most guys on a scale of 1 to 10, that's like a 12, because they'll never do it.
Right.
But he wants to have it be a 7 or 8 and be a non-dunker.
Yeah, he has been a pleasure to watch so far. They're actually really good.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing about it, as much as I am not a Coach K guy, is Coach K is hip now. Like,
he's okay with the one and dones.
Coach K is about as hip as he can be. Coach K is now at a point where not only is he okay with the one and dones, but he's okay with just letting the kids play basketball. And things change. Like, this isn't 1990 when you got Leitner and Bobby Hurley and Thomas Hill and Grant Hill, and you have this stacked roster of guys who you know are going to be there for 4 years. And if they don't like how you're coaching them, they can go somewhere else. He's had to make accommodations to how he coaches this group. And a lot of coaches, Bobby Knight would be one, were he still coaching, and he's not. A lot of coaches would have really struggled to change as the game has changed. And he may have struggled. And you are old enough, obviously, so am I, to remember when Elton Brand was one of the first Duke early draft declarations, and you would have thought the world was ending. But Krzyzewski realized pretty quickly, like, he wasn't going to be able to get away with that anymore.
No, he evolved. You're right. And the thing that he did is he kept his personality and the way that he influences the program. That hasn't changed, because his mindset of, you know, valuing every possession, being intense, tough defense, you know, strategizing down the stretch, calling timeouts, he can still do that and make his mark and be the great coach that he is, but evolve in those other ways that, as you've described.
Yeah, so it has been interesting to watch college so far this year, and will continue to be pretty cool to see as it goes. And by the time those who are listening to the show on Sunday night will hear this, the Patriots will know their fate.
Yes, they will. Finally.
Whether they will go on for another week, we shall see. Oh, wait. So we're actually acting like we're a real radio talk show. We're going to be joined by Bedford High hockey coach Glenn Fifield, girls hockey coach. So hang on.
Patch him in.
Coach, you there?
Yes, I am. How you doing, Lauren?
Doing well. How are you?
Very good.
Good. We're actually running this thing like a real talk show, like we were in the middle of talking about something, and then the phone rang, and there you go. So you're being recorded right now.
Okay.
So are you ready?
I'm ready to go.
All right. We're here with Bedford High girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield. And Coach, thank you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lauren.
So I have Andrew Hansen with me as well. And year two, of course, you guys were the feel-good story last winter, starting things up from scratch. Great group of girls, and just a wonderful thing to see. A lot of people had said going in, hey, you're going to be lucky to score goals in year one, and you guys were winning games in year one. But what did you learn in year one that was the most important?
Actually, I learned that we have a tremendous amount of support building off that from the school and the community. As a first-year high school coach, there are a lot of puzzle pieces to put together and to create that girls' culture in the community. Corey Parker was right there, always supporting the program, and as well as all the members of the boys' hockey community. So it just, the amount of support, I'm like, was tremendous. And I just learned how much of a hockey culture is truly right there in Bedford.
Well, it's indicative of how the community can get behind things as well. And even I think back to last March when Tim Schaller came out to the bank, and the girls were there and ready to meet him and had the meet and greet. And they were, every single one of them on the team was happy to be there and as polite as can be, and just a wonderful representation of the program as a whole.
Yes. That's part of our culture to where it is. It goes beyond just hockey. It goes to where we are as citizens and everything else within the community. And it really, I know it's sports and it's high school and competitive, but they do truly have a great time doing what they're doing.
That's it's a lot of fun. So in year one, of course, there were some wins, not always expected, and a lot of goals too. But what were some of your favorite moments during the season?
One of them, and it doesn't even come from gameplay, but one of them comes from, we had a combined practice with the boys JV that Marty invited us to. And what really came out of that was a new level of compete and a new way to practice for the girls, that they really understood as they were just learning to skate, it actually taught them the next level that they could really get themselves to. So that was really one of those, a fine moment for me. Another one is how much the girls really love the game for the sake of playing the game. It didn't matter what the score was or what was happening on there. They were always excited, ready, and giving their best and ready for the next shift, no matter what.
One of my favorite memories, Coach, was I went to the last game of the year, and I saw the girls afterwards interact with the crowd, and it was one of those moments that I'm sure the players and coaches and fans will remember as the positive end to that first season. And here you are now in year two, and one of the key components of your squad has been Maddie Lucantoni, because she was your captain last year as a junior. Now she's one of three captains this year. So how do you get those younger players who are less experienced up to speed?
Really, with the structure of our practices and the support of volunteer coaches beyond myself and my assistant coach, Marissa, beyond that, in the structure of our practice, we are able to break down the team into smaller groups and coach those groups to each skill set to where they're at. So we can really, depending on what the skill set of the group has, we can really push them to excel. So they're building their own skill sets. And then when we get into a team play, they work into the team play and push each other in that way.
So as it pertains to Maddie and your other senior goalie, or your senior goalie, Hannah Paradise, you're losing both of them after the season. That's going to be a tough leadership void to fill ultimately.
Yeah, and actually, as Andrew said, we have three captains this year, in addition to Maddie and Hannah, with senior Carly Tishon. They've all done a tremendous job as liaisons for the coaching staff, really going between working with us and communicating with us and us to them in between the team, and that's how I've really set up the team and communications with the team. But we have a strong culture of support within our team for each other and team members, and I feel that they've done a great job, and we've worked with them to really look for the next group of leaders within the team and mentor that next group, so it's not a void or a vacuum that's being filled afterwards. It's actually that next one has already been mentored into it with an understanding of what their role would be coming in. Players don't know who it is, but it's just a matter of they're always on the horizon, and we're looking for them and mentor those type of leaders that we see.
It's always one of the toughest things about a high school program is by the time they're completely ingrained in the culture, they're no longer part of the program.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, the good thing is last year we had two freshmen that were on a varsity program. Again, this year we have two more freshmen that are on the varsity program. So those girls will be right with us right through like 4 years of the program starting right out. So culture-wise, as we go forward and with not having a JV program, that culture will be easily carried up as we develop freshmen right into our program. So the culture, it won't be just a 1 or 2 year thing. We'll be able to have that as a 4 year thing.
And that makes your life way easier as the coach. We're here with Bedford High girls hockey coach Glenn Fifield, who is in year two and the program's in year two. But we discussed this last year, and others have let me know that you have some first year skaters on the roster. So it's the challenge of some of the more experienced players who have been there and played in travel programs, and some who are really just learning the game from the ground or from the ice up. How do you keep the more experienced players engaged while ensuring that the greener ones develop at a rapid rate?
We really have clear expectations that are spoken within classroom time and on the ice to where it is to our experienced players. And those same expectations are spoken to our new players. This year, we only have one new skater. And the good part is within our development this year, the girls have really pushed themselves in the off season and really developed their skating. So we went from where last year, we'll call it the learn to skate kind of program, to now it's really developed into as we develop into gameplay and not understanding where they are. So they've really advanced. They took the off season real serious and really worked on their skating skills. And it's allowed us to really develop as a team and start to get a better team understanding with team play and not just so much focus on skating skills.
Coach, during the offseason, you mentioned the girls working on their skating. Are there any of your players who participate on travel teams where they're getting a lot of games in during the offseason?
There was, unfortunately, not as many that were there or available. A lot of them play fall sports. And with them starting out to join a travel team, where their skill sets are, it was hard for them to fit into a travel team early on. I'm hoping in the second year with their gameplay understandings higher that they can fit into a travel team. There was four players that played either club or rec program in the fall.
So it makes it tough for them because it's not obviously a year-round sport. And even for somebody who's an athlete, hockey really isn't an easy game. Skating is a super unique skill. If you were going to recruit junior high girls to play, what advice would you give them if they're not coming to you from a travel program?
Get out public skating and pond skating as much as you possibly can. I'm like, that. There's the fun. I'm like, you can get out there and not worry about the exposure to things. There are learn to skate programs out there. Actually, last year in the fall, I put together a high school development program for girls of all within the area that anybody that wanted to join to help really work on the skill sets of leading into the high school programs. It just really focused on skill sets with puck handling and skating skill sets. But those junior high players, I would say, if you're interested in it, find a learn to skate, get out there public skating, skate with your friends whenever you get a chance to, just get out there doing some old school pond skating.
Yeah, there's nothing better than good pond skate on a nice cold day. So for you, what are some of the bright spots so far this year? The team's got 3 wins so far. What's the outlook for the remainder of the season?
The outlook's bright. I think we've played some hard games lately and given up some stuff, but we're a very resilient team. And we've overcome some serious adversities and tragedies, but it's made us stronger as a unit early on in the season. So it's really brought us together. There's no real complacency within the girls. So they're always pushing and striving. And I look to the second half of our schedule and really see some moments when we can really flourish as a team as we, again, build to develop and work as a team, and they gain that gameplay understanding and push themselves towards that. And with each game, they gain more and more confidence, which is huge, which is really key, especially the way the coaching staff works with them to bolster their confidence.
Well, I remember having the same feeling last year when we interviewed you about the passion and the excitement that you bring and how fortunate the girls are to have a coach like you and a coaching staff like you've assembled to lead them into hopefully what's ultimately a lifelong love of the game of hockey.
Yeah, it was funny because one of the seniors that had graduated, came by to our game last night and she visited us, Kara Rapp. She came by she's like, there's where she's going out in California, there's no ice, there's no frozen water, there's nothing. And she's like, she was at the game and she missed it so much just watching our game. And she actually is like, she said she was more nervous watching our game with anxiety than she was actually taking her finals before she came home.
Yeah.
So she definitely grew into the passion for the sport.
It's, I'll tell you, as a kid coming from Southern California to here, I had never skated on a pond. And the idea that this weird body of water was okay, this is okay, and I can actually skate on this thing. But you grow to realize that that's one of the best things about living out here is you have winter and you have two choices. You can either be stuck inside or you can use winter. And it's the people who realize, hey, you can get out and have a little bit of fun, whether you're skiing or skating, you name it. It's fun to see that you're sharing that with the girls. So, Coach, I know you have to get back to work, but as always, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Lauren.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Good luck the rest of the way.
Thank you. Bye.
That was Coach Glenn Fifield of the Bedford High Girls Hockey Program. Yeah, it's funny. I remember having the exact same, like, the feeling after you, like, I'm like, I want to go play. Like, sign me up.
Yeah, and it was fun to hear.
I'm old and I'm a male, but I'll go, you know.
Yeah, and it was fun.
Skate circles around me.
It's fun to hear that last story about the returning player because she obviously had pride in the program where she's watching and she's anxious about how the team's going to perform. So that was a really fun thing to hear. And that, you know, we're only in year two, so that's just going to continue to grow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it's also the neat thing for the college. We saw it at the basketball game a couple weeks ago. The kids who are in college who come back a year or 2 years after, like, they're coming back because they want to see the coach and they want to see friends, but they also, there's sort of an emotional investment in the program that you want to make sure that everything's okay after you left. And it seemed in the case of a senior that came back for last night's game, like that was kind of what she was angling for. So very cool. And certainly if you have an opportunity, get out, watch those girls play. There is a website, bedfordhockey.com, which has all the information about roster, upcoming games, you name it. So it's a group that can certainly use your support, and they would be happy to have anybody yelling, screaming. I don't know if they allow cowbells in the rink. But, yeah, anything you can do to go and show your support for the Bedford High girls hockey team, by all means, they will appreciate it. So we'll take a quick break and come right back with Bedford High ski coach Phil Axton, and you are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by Bedford High skiing coach Phil Axton. Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. How are we doing today?
Doing great. We always love the enthusiasm. So for you, or for any of us, it's been kind of a weird ski year. How many days do you have in? And I know your home mountain is Pat's. Have you been anywhere but Pat's so far?
We started after Christmas on snow, the day after, and we've been hitting it hard at Pat's. Our first away race will be this coming next Friday at Gunstock.
Nice. Very cool. So a week from, we're recording on Friday, so a week from today, up at Gunstock, always a fun mountain to head out to. And for you, two races in, a good start to the season. The boys and girls both won their first two races. CJ Ledoux, who we know from his work on the golf course, he's won a couple of them, and Jessica Ryu won one on the girls' side. How does race season work as far as figuring out winners, losers, all that sort of stuff?
Especially with those two, they've been around the ski industry for a while, racing in club racing, high school racing, and with the experience, they know what to do, you know, in the certain courses. They're ski club races, the USSA racers. And then you have, like, the regular general public that come and race. Now, when you're racing USSA, it's like you're an individual, you're striving for points, you're going all out. It's either you're finishing or you're pretty much crashing. So they know when they come to the high school level, you're skiing about 80% at that point. Consistency in the high school level is the key. If you're a good skier and you get the experience, that's the key to any success with the high school program.
Wonderful. We're here with Phil Axton, the coach of the Bedford High Alpine Skiing Program, and the teams are doing well. Obviously, they've won their first couple races, but it's been a weird year for snow. It's been a slow start for the snow season, although I was up at Pat's last Saturday, which, even though it was raining out there, was in surprisingly good shape. How do you train skiers in the off season?
Well, I have an assistant coach, Jessica Fahey. She's actually still a racer, a USSA racer. And what we do is we'll model an Olympic athlete. And she picked a girl from Canada. I can't think of her name offhand. But we'll follow her dry land training to a T. And we take it to our kids. We start right after Thanksgiving, 3 days a week. And we have the nice stadium there or some hills we'll find. And we pretty much follow like an Olympic, their program, what they do during the off season. And there's a lot of team bonding also. We'll throw in some fun games at the end, that which they all like. And the high school ski racing is unique or any team ski racing, it's different than when you're just, you know, skiing singularly. You need that, really, the team bonding. Everyone's pretty much going to get along, and it's a great atmosphere when you get through that, you know, with the different personalities.
Coach, in addition to the team building, what about with the individual technique? You know, what's your focus during the season on helping these kids improve their performance?
Well, like a lot of the kids that I've known, the returners, I kind of know how to push them when we're up at the gates, when we're up at the start house. And I'm getting to learn the new kids, whether to fire them up or if they're a little shy, it may not be as abrupt, take it a little bit down a notch. I know some are really, they'll get like butterflies, and I'll talk about whatever, they're something else other than skiing. When they're about to go within like 2 minutes of their run, I'll talk about if they have another interest, and I try to keep your mind off, because it's definitely gets in your head, and you watch someone in front of you crash, that's always something to worry about and everything else. So, you know, depending on each person, I try to, you know, try to develop a little relationship as far as what they need to do to get a good job down the course.
Here with Bedford High ski coach Phil Axton, and you're talking about the sort of individualized coaching you provide. Is there any opportunity to break down film with any of the skiers?
We're talking about that this year, because every now and then we're going to get a rainy day, and they have this on the ski industry. We use coach's eye. You take an iPad and we'll do their runs. Usually what we do is, Coach Jesser and I will start. We at practice, they'll go down. We'll start at the start house, watch them from there. Then we'll go halfway, watch them individually, and then we'll go to the end, and then we'll critique, hey, you need to lean forward. Your line's going to be a little bit more higher. But then we were talking about actually using the coach's eye. They use that in the USSA race, the club races. They do that all the time so they can see exactly what they're doing wrong or what they're doing right.
It's amazing, you know? It's amazing what technology can do, because I've used that for coaching baseball as well. And the opportunity you have to really break somebody down and look at the various either arm angles, leg angles, you name it. I mean, you can really improve somebody simply by watching that.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's an unbelievable tool. Unbelievable.
So for you, of course, you inherit skiers with various equipment, uniforms. How much influence can you have on recommending whether somebody's skis are tuned appropriately, the wax that they're using, whether they're wearing something that's going to cost them time, save them time? How much sway can you have over that?
Absolutely. For the regular, the general public, they just watch someone coming down the mountain. They're thinking they're on snow, but actually, if you went up to where they're going around the gates, a lot of times they inject water. It's ice. The firmer the snow or ice is, the better off. So with that, like you said, we need to really, the most important is the edges on your skis. That's number one. A lot of these kids that are the club racers are either doing it themselves or their parents are doing it, and you get down to like 3 degrees. There's different degrees and everything else as far as, your edge control. And then your waxes on GS, your waxes are really important. GS is a giant slalom, so the turns are less, so you're gliding a lot more. And that's where you need the wax. And the different waxes definitely help. Every little bit helps. And you get into the GS suits, the study has shown that, you can take off 1 or 2 seconds because of the resistance of the wind. And actually, they've gotten so slippery out there that they're actually putting restrictions on the suits now in the industry, because what's happening is they'll fall and they start sliding real fast. So now they're coming up with a fist suit that actually grips when you fall. But the equipment is key, definitely key. Every little bit helps a little bit more. Obviously, you need you need race skis to do a little bit better. You don't absolutely need them. I have some non-USSA kids on the team. They have regular all-mountain skis, and they do very well. I have two park kids on twin tips, and they're hanging with the best of them. So, it's not like you need it, but it definitely helps.
So for younger skiers who aspire to ski in high school quickly, because I know you have to go, what advice would you give them?
Just keep trying. It's a blast. The kids all, it's a huge bonding, especially when you're new into the high school, you're freshman, and you can't, and then you have your seniors. There's like little cliques and everything else. I try to break everything away from that, and I want them all unit as a team. And it's just unique compared to other sports. It is a team, but then it comes down to the individual. And, we have some up-and-coming freshmen that have been really showing well and the seniors and juniors, and they all like that. It's just it's a fun time. It's a great atmosphere. It's not like football where, everybody's taking their head off, or baseball. It's you're a team, but again, everybody is, scoring individually.
It's a challenge, but the kids are lucky to have the opportunity to do it, and they're lucky to have you be a part of it. Now, for you, what's your favorite mountain?
I go back and forth. I love them all. I'm an East Coast skier.
Yep.
And about 5 years ago, I went out west, Utah. And I'll tell you, I years ago I went to California, but I love Alta.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I got the bug. I never thought I was gonna say that. I loved all. I like the Killingtons, the Sunday Rivers, the Gunstocks. I love Pats. I'm in there Pats all the time. My son, he's out this year. He got injured, so we won't see him on the rolls. Injured in football. But the thing I like about Pats is he's not huge line. And it's a very safe mountain. The kids there are really nice. I don't see a lot of, sometimes you see a little bit of riffraff in some of the parks and stuff like that. But Pats, very clean, nice atmosphere. And a lot of people go skiing way up north, like Loon. I love Loon, but I don't like the lines. I hate waiting in line. And so, Pats, you're up and down. It's a short mountain, but, I get a lot of ski runs in. So I like them all. They all offer something different.
It's awesome. All right. Glad to hear it. Go to work. And as always, we appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you, Coach.
All right.
That was Bedford High ski coach Phil Axton, and we will take a quick break and come back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports, Bedford 105.1. Before Coach Byfield called in, and then we spoke to Coach Axton, we were starting to talk about football, and now we are back on football. So here we are, the NFL rolling into the weekend. I'm excited.
Yeah.
I am ready for some football.
That's right. Nice warm-up last weekend with four interesting games.
I got the pig in the ground. I got the beer on ice. All my rowdy friends are coming over tonight.
I do know
it
that
would be
song.
Tough to
I know
put,
that song.
It would be tough to put a pig in the ground right now. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
All right. So, all right. NFL last week. What did we have?
We had Andrew Luck rising to the occasion as predicted.
Yes.
By one of us.
By you. Yeah. I really didn't think Houston was going to have the issues that they did. Although, for anybody who hasn't followed it, there's a Twitter account called Captain Andrew Luck. And basically, it's putting him like he's a Civil War captain, because if you look at him with his copious amounts of neck hair, my wife said he looked like Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
It's random things like just the post from when was the date of the last game? That was, here you go, January 5th. Dearest mother, my time away from home shall be extended. The unit was victorious over the Texan men. Stupendous. It was a hard-fought battle, but our lines held strong. I am so thrilled my pen trembles as I write. My sidearm and resolve are true. I love you, Andrew.
That's wonderful.
And then, what? Here we go. There's the next day. Our dearest mother, our victory frolicking has ceased. We must now begin our march to Kansas City to battle the unit of such great stature. Every member has been granted the title of chief. Our path has been long and winding, but I have never seen the men's spirits higher. Andrew. And then January 9th. I have received your care package of braised pigeon shins and fresh squirrel oil. By way of chief trickery, the unit lost a day's travel after reaching Lawrence, only to discover Kansas City is actually in Missouri. No bother. Our focus remains unfazed. So,
is the squirrel oil, is that what he puts on his shoulder?
I have no idea what the squirrel oil is a reference to. I wish I knew. I mean, it's lost on me.
Well, he did miss last year because of his shoulder injury.
I know.
Well, I know you know. But maybe that's what he uses as shoulder balm. Is
the only two things that Captain Andrew Luck follows on Twitter are Ken Burns and the Indianapolis Colts. I enjoy when people do things right. Like, he's not following anybody back. He's got close to 500,000 followers, and he's tweeting just garbage. Utter garbage. It's like the old Haas Radborn Twitter account. So anyway, Indy, Houston, you had Indy. I had Houston. You won that one. Seattle, we both had over Dallas. Or
Seattle, Dallas.
Seattle covered as a 2.5-point dog. Dallas.
Thanks to a 2-point conversion.
Late. Yeah, exactly.
Because Janikowski blew out his hamstring.
Right. We'll go into the gory details later. That was a mess. San Diego covered over Baltimore. And then I had the Eagles, you had the Bears. So both of us went 3-1. And we both lost on the total, which was a 43.
Seattle-Dallas.
In that Seattle-Dallas game. So looking at Indy Houston, I was surprised that Deshaun Watson and company were not able to vanquish Captain Andrew Luck, but he's looking good.
He is. No, he's in a groove. You know, he and Frank Reich, they've got the troops organized and operating at top-notch levels.
Yes. So, yeah, they're looking good. However, they go into Kansas City, not Kansas, but Missouri.
Correct.
to take on the Chiefs, 5.5-point favorites. Who do you like?
I'm going with Andrew Luck.
You think it's Captain Andrew Luck.
Yep.
Hanson takes that. I take the Chiefs. Total's 56. Are you taking over or under?
Ooh, I'll go over.
Okay. We're going opposite sides. I'm taking under. I hate being an under better.
Yeah, it's not
ever.
Fun.
Well, if you're under, like, let's just say for sake of argument, I don't know if I ever mentioned, like, on the show, my handicapping days. I don't know if we ever talked about that in length, but the totals, particularly when you're betting an under, can do such weird things. Like, let's just say for sake of argument, the Chiefs are up 35-14 in the game and you feel like things are nice and comfortable, or 35-15, they have a two-point conversion somewhere along the way or something weird happens, the Colts wind up scoring a meaningless touchdown late. Suddenly you're over that 56.
Right.
That's the problem with being the under better, is the game can be well in hand and you still have action that's going on that is not relevant to anything that right. nobody can predict.
Especially when you get in those last 5 minutes and a team is up by, let's say, at least 14, more like maybe 17, so it's three scores. The other team's just playing the prevent right. defense. They don't care if they score a touchdown. They just want the clock to run.
Just give me the ball back and let the clock run. It's so, yeah, that... So we'll see what happens there.
Speaking of over-unders,
yeah.
we got just segue or take a sidestep to the NBA for a second.
What? Go.
You think about over-unders, and it was 224, I think.
220, 221, whatever.
It was San Antonio, OKC?
No, I know, it was 224.
Around 224, and they scored 301.
Yeah. Well, they played two overtimes.
Yeah. So it's just funny how usually these lines are so close, but then you get one that's just blown out of the water in a historic game. Was it 154-147?
Yeah.
Double overtime?
Yeah.
Well, just amazing.
Anytime you go into overtime, like the single worst thing for a total is college football overtime, because that's really one, the expression all bets are off, really all bets are off, because if you go touchdown, 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 next, that's 28 points. Like, you could have been rolling along with a total of 28 and the line set at, or the over-under set at 39, and now all of a sudden you're at 56, like, because you're playing on this weird short field. The NBA is similar, particularly you're asking guys to, they're putting on an offensive show at this point. Defense is not their prime concern. And then all of a sudden in overtime, defense kind of becomes a bit of a concern and guys are trying to lock down, but it doesn't happen. It seems like this year, more than any I remember in recent memory, overtime has become fireworks.
And then it's different, of course, with the NFL, because now it's only 10 minutes,
yeah.
and it could end with a safety or a field goal and the other team doesn't score. So you don't, it's so different than college, you know, and maybe this weekend we'll get an overtime game. That would be fun.
It would be nice to see that. So, all right, the second game yesterday or last week that you and I both got, because Seattle was a 2.5-point dog. Seattle plus 2.5 against Dallas. Dallas won by 2. But that was a weird game.
Yeah, it was. It was. I expected a little bit more out of Seattle's offense. And then the one thing that sticks out to me from that game is just the end game with the onside kick. And for those who haven't noticed, they've changed the rules with kickoffs and onside kicks. So you can't overload a bunch of guys on one side and get a running start. And because of that, the onside kick recovery rate is at, I think, 7 or 8% for the season. And so it just really ruins the, you know, down by 2 or 3 scores in the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you have a real chance to come back? It's almost impossible to recover the onside kick now.
Well, in the case of that Seattle-Dallas game, too, you had Sebastian Janikowski, who I think might have replaced George Blanda as the Raiders kicker back in the 70s. But Janikowski was kicking for Seattle. They asked him to come out and kick a 57-yard field goal right before halftime. He pulls his hammy. And this kind of gets into the next thing. And not a special teams player, me. I've played football and I can throw a spiral and whatnot, but like didn't play football in high school. So feel free to tell me if I don't know what I'm talking about, but they bust out their punter as the kicker or attempt to. He goes out at halftime and it's like shank after shank after shank. And Pete Carroll just looks at it and goes, I got nothing. Like, I can't use this guy. I have a 53-man roster and this guy is my next logical fit. And I can't use him to even kick an extra point. I'm doing two-point conversions. If I need him to kick a field goal, I'm not really comfortable doing that. He looks that bad. Then he goes to kick the onside kick. And, of course, the onside kick rules, the ball's got to travel 10 yards before it's touched. Well, he pooches it about 30-something yards, where unless Usain Bolt hops on a Segway, nobody's getting the onside kick.
Yeah, and they had no chance to recover that.
And Pete Carroll's just there shaking his head, the Silver Fox, and...
1X.
Yeah, just 1X. But I guess there are two questions here. One, if you're a punter and you're hanging out with special teams people all the time, don't you think you ever, like, just the same way that just about every baseball player has a knuckleball?
Right.
Don't just you think fun. You would have been like, hey, tee it up. I'm going to kick a couple. Like,
yeah.
In high school or in college or in the NFL. Like, don't you think that would have happened? That's thing one. And thing two is, a lot of guys in the NFL, Russell Wilson's one that I think of, are good athletes. I would be shocked if Russell Wilson hasn't kicked at some point.
Yeah, either as a football player in high school or even as a soccer player. And you're right. These punters, they have an incredibly strong leg. So they've got the power.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of downtime in practice. I mean, you don't want your punter out practicing tackling, right? You don't want to practice that. You want to keep him healthy. So he's just standing there on the sidelines for hours on end. And why not mix in 15 minutes per practice? You should have somebody else on the 53-man roster who can kick if somebody goes down.
Right. I will say this about Russell Wilson. He was all-district, all-region, all-state football player. He was the senior class president, and he was a member of the basketball and baseball teams. However, it does not indicate on Wikipedia that he was kicking at any point in time. It just strikes me, and I don't know, obviously, I'm not well-versed in who the punters are for all the NFL teams. It just seems like at some point this would have been a thing.
And the thing about kicking is it's not like you need somebody with a particular body type. I mean, a lot of the kickers are pretty small, but there's no reason why you can't have a tight end somewhere or a wide receiver who's got the hand, you know, got the leg-eye coordination to be able to go practice some and step in when needed. Because that completely changed the strategy for Seattle down the stretch.
Yes.
They scored that late touchdown, and they went for two. So now they're down two. If they had recovered the onside kick, what would Pete Carroll have done? He didn't want to attempt a field goal. Would they have gone for it on fourth down from the 20?
Yeah.
Because he didn't even want to have anybody go out there and shank one?
Hey, who knows? I think the other thing that might enter into things as far as Michael Dixon goes is he's Australian. So he's an Aussie rules football guy and a soccer guy, but not a football rat.
Well, and you're going to the tight ends for Seattle. They have like 12 tight ends, so there's got to be one of them who can kick a field goal.
Yes, it's true.
Nick Vanette. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, there's got to be. Pete Carroll's got to have something up his sleeve, but regardless. So Dallas won that one 24-22. Dallas goes into L.A. as 7-point dogs. Who do you like?
The Rams.
Yeah, I got to take the Rams, too.
I don't think Dallas has much of a chance. I think this could get ugly.
Yes.
And by the way, I just heard that Cole Beasley didn't practice all week. Their up-and-coming tight end, Jarwin, who caught 3 touchdowns in the season finale, I don't know that he's going to play.
I had completely forgotten about Allen Hurns, but thank you for bringing up Dallas wide receivers.
No. I didn't intend to bring that one up, but yeah, you're right. I actually had as well.
Yeah,
so it's down to Cooper and Zeke, and that's just not enough variety to deal with LA, because they're going to be putting up a bunch of points. Dallas's defense has been better, but you know, LA's had a week to recover. Gurley's back and ready to go. I think they could easily win by 14 or more.
Total, 50.
I'll go under.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I'm going under on that one, too, because I like the Rams putting up 35 or something. But Dallas has a good D. I just don't like Dallas putting up any points.
Yeah, 35
like,
to 10.
That's what I struggle with. Like, Dak has no options. Like, yeah, Witten's going to be out of the broadcast booth.
By the way, who do you have as a better playoff quarterback, Dak or Tom Brady?
What do you...
This is a legit question, because Stephen A. put up his top 5 playoff quarterbacks. Andrew Luck was at the top, then it was Mahomes, then it was Rivers, then it was Dak Prescott, and Tom Brady was 5th.
Yeah, I struggle with that. Like, I don't know. Even if Tom Brady's 73 years old, like, I know.
I don't care what metric you use. Tom is ahead of Dak Prescott.
Well, you have to at some point look at a guy and say, what he's done in the past matters. And what he's done in the past matters.
Right. Like, what has Dak done?
Not a whole lot.
Not much.
I like Dak.
I do too. He's
not
fine.
Tom Brady.
He's fine.
Yeah. So, all right. Getting back to last week's NFL, Baltimore, I liked them, but we both took San Diego. And San Diego won and covered, even though it was closer than would have indicated. The the main takeaway from that game, and it drives me nuts watching some of these games, they kept going shooting the bench, and there's Joe Flacco sitting there. There is no quarterback controversy. There is no quarterback controversy. You take a kid who is athletic and smart and, by all accounts, the quarterback of your future versus a guy who, even though he begged to be considered an elite quarterback, was not an elite quarterback in Joe Flacco, there's no controversy there.
And I think that move by Harbaugh to leave the Super Bowl MVP on the bench in Joe Flacco is going to pay big dividends
down the road. That.
He let Jackson stay out there, and he had done nothing offensively. Throwing, he had done almost less than nothing. Wasn't it at some point in the third quarter, their passing yardage was negative?
It was zero or negative, yeah.
It was like negative two in the third quarter. But he left him out there, and he threw two touchdowns late.
Yeah.
Gave them a chance to actually win, and to have that confidence of his coach stuck with him, he can always look back on that and and have those two touchdowns in his memory bank of actual success in the playoffs after all of his incredible rushing success down the stretch as he led the team to, what, a 6-1 record?
Yeah.
So I think that was just a huge move.
I think if you put Flacco in at that point, you're basically mortgaging your future.
Yep.
To attempt to win one game. Because, okay, even if you win that game with Flacco and Flacco leads you back, what do you do next week? Okay, Lamar, you're on the bench. Flacco's starting. Now you've manufactured a controversy for a week. And as much as the networks really seem to want Harbaugh to bite, like, he's not watching the game, but, like, that was their storyline, which it was just a fail. Like, just let it go. Like, this is the guy who's playing. It was Flacco. He got Wally Pipped. Like, it is what it is. Jackson is not a surprise, and I certainly hope that he gets the opportunity to continue to hone his craft in the NFL and doesn't become one of the flavor of the month guys, because he could be a really good charismatic guy for the NFL to roll with for a few years too.
It will be fascinating to see what happens with him in the next couple of years. Do they continue to have that much of an emphasis on the running game with the ball in Jackson's hands? Can he stand up to the physical demands of carrying it more than 10 times a game and all those hits? I mean, hopefully for his sake, he can, but I have to imagine they're going to start to throw the ball a little bit more next year.
Yes.
You know, and especially after this success that he had in the playoffs.
He can, though. Like, he there's no question he can throw. So, and then looking at the aftermath of that game, the Patriots, 4-point favorites over San Diego, or over LA, the Chargers.
Who you got?
I like the Chargers in that one.
I like the Patriots in that one.
Okay.
The Chargers, they're a great story, but I think it ends this weekend.
I think it may end this weekend. I just think that the Patriots as 4-point favorites over the Chargers is unrealistic.
Well, Rivers is what, 0-7 against Brady?
Yeah.
They got to go all the way to New England and play in the cold?
Yeah.
Doesn't help?
Yeah. Totals 47, over, under.
What do you got?
I go over.
I'll go over as well.
All right. And then the last game of the week, last week, boy, was that a dandy on Sunday night.
Oh, my gosh. Not for those who enjoy it when the Bears are victorious.
The Eagles march down and get a little bit of Nick Foles magic and go ahead 16-15. The Bears get a 35-yard kickoff return and a couple plays and set things up for a pretty pedestrian 43-yard field goal, which...
He made it.
Doink.
But there was a timeout.
Yep. He made the first one straight as a string, and then the second one, doink, doink.
Unbelievable.
Astonishing.
The thing about the first one was it seemed like he really put a lot of energy and effort into it. Like, I don't blame him for going through the motions and making the kick, you know, because you've got to train yourself to proceed with the plan because you don't know if Coach Peterson's going to call a timeout or not. So you just have to be in the mindset of, I'm just going to go kick this field goal, whether they call a timeout or not. So he did it, but it just looked like he had to really give it all he had to get it to 43 yards for some reason. And then the second time around, the most incredible deflection you could ever imagine. I mean, that I don't think it's ever happened. There's never been a playoff game to end on
doink,
a play
doink.
Like that.
Yeah, I was sitting there just astonished. So the... as always happens, Goose Island, which is probably the most well-known Chicago brewery, has now given fans the opportunity to kick a 43-yard field goal outside their tap room on Fulton Street in Chicago. The field goal challenge rules, you have to be 21 or over, one kick per person, 43-yard field goal, sign up at noon, kick at 1, and then you get a year's supply of, was it a year's supply of beer?
I think so.
So, yes. And then all referee calls are final in that one.
Does your kick get partially blocked?
I don't know. That's the other thing. Like, we all have gone out to a high school field. We used to go in college to the USC practice field and go and kick field goals. And like, hey, I just kicked a 40-whatever-yarder. This is great. But like the trajectory of the kicks that we're kicking, I know I'm not getting over a line. Like if there's a guy who's 6'5" with his hands up, I'm not clearing 8-9 feet. No chance. So are they going to put a line, like an artificial line there? Is this going to be televised? I have so many questions. So it is.
That would be a great way to do it, actually, is put up a bar at about the height of that Eagles defensive lineman's hand and say it's only good if you kick it over the bar.
I love how Goose Island repped this guy, though. A lot of armchair kickers are on here saying they could hit that field goal, which we find doubtful. You're going to sit there on your throne of potato chips and criticize this dude's athleticism? Get real. I love it.
Yeah, I'm just thankful for Cody Parkey.
Yes.
That it has come out that it was partially blocked.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't turn into the next Bartman in Chicago.
The diabolical Biz Parkey. So the other side of that, the Saints by 8 over the Eagles. What do you think?
I got the Saints.
Yeah, I got the Saints too. Over 51.5.
I'm going to go under.
I'm going to go over. So
I don't have much faith in the Eagles. I mean, Nick Foles is wonderful. I love that he has led them the way that he does. He's just a winner. He just finds a way to win. But the Eagles got destroyed earlier in the season when they went to New Orleans. The Saints have, great home field advantage. Drew Brees is unstoppable at home. They've got a week to rest. And I really like where they're at mentally. Did you hear the story of what Sean Payton did with their crew before this week?
No.
He made this big display where he brought in the Vince Lombardi trophy from when they won the Super Bowl, and he brought in real cash, $200,000 in cash, and put it in front of the players and said, this is what's at stake. Because the playoff bonus apparently now for the NFL guys, if they go all the way and win the Super Bowl, the individual player bonus is $201,000.
Right, which to some is not much.
But
if you're the 53rd guy on the roster, that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, I mean, there's some guys making around $1 million or even a little bit less.
Yeah.
That's a huge bonus.
Right.
And it's something that doesn't really get talked about that much in the media. That's a significant bonus. That's a lot that these guys are playing for. But even guys like Mark Ingram, who make significant money and have made significant money, said just seeing the cash there was really kind of motivating. And apparently Peyton is really great at these motivational speeches, does a lot of creative things. And I like that mentality that he's setting with the guys of, hey, this is what we're after here, and we think we can go get it.
Well,
you don't just do that with a team that you're not even sure if they're going to make the playoffs. I mean, he's showing them the confidence of, I think you guys can do it. I think you can win it all. This is what we're all about. Let's go get it, and this is what we're going to get. It's tangible. It's right in front of you. Go out and get it.
Thanks for the setup. It wouldn't be the first time Sean Payton had paid his guys to do something on the field. Just saying.
No, that was only the defensive coordinator. He had nothing to do with that.
It's just a perfect setup. Anyway. So, if you can make it out to Chicago this weekend, you can win free beer. I'd go.
That'd be fun to try.
Oh, my God. That would be so much fun to try. You cannot send in a video. So, nope. You got to complete the kick outside our brewery. Everybody knows what a nut I am for a good marketing stunt, and I wholeheartedly approve. So, all right. With that said, another great week. Thanks to our guests, Glenn Fifield of the Bedford High Girls Hockey Program, Phil Axton of the Alpine Skiing Program. Thank you to Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, Colleen Richardson, and especially Chris Gentry, who is leaving us for other pastures that aren't necessarily greener. But Chris, thank you for everything that you've done for us. We appreciate it more than you know. So,
Chris, thanks a lot. We'll miss you. Best of luck.
Yeah, and we can't wait to see you back here someday soon. So, that said, have a great sports week. Go Pats, and we'll catch you next week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.